This is Table Talk with former California State Fire Marshal Ronnie J. Coleman and your host, Michael Williams.
Hello, welcome to this episode of Table Talk with retired California State Fire Marshal Ronnie J. Coleman and your host, Michael Williams. Today we're going to talk about the fire marshal. Chief, welcome to the table.
Glad to be here.
I came from the law enforcement world, and I knew what a fire marshal was. I interacted with them periodically here and there, and I always enjoyed working with the arson investigators, particularly down when I was in Los Angeles. I always thought that was cool. We could get on the radio and get a couple of arson investigators right away. I never really stopped to think about what the fire marshal was until I got involved in the fire service. And even then, I didn't really know much about it. It was not until years later. And then I began to appreciate that there is a whole nother world to the fire service other than just fire suppression, and that's fire prevention in the fire marshal's office. What is the fire marshal?
Well, it's not Jim Carrey. you remember him?
Yes.
Fire Marshal Bill. I mean, he caused this great big uproar one time because he had this comedy routine. And the reason I even start off with a joke is the word fire marshal, for the most part, is kind of transparent to society in general. If you say fire marshal to most people, I think the first thing that leaps to their mind is somebody showing up at a public assembly and shutting down the operation and telling everybody they have to get out of a building. That's where most people think the word fire marshal. You know, fire marshal is the guy that, literally though, a fire marshal is the architect of the community fire problem. The fire marshal is a position, a staff position, within the context of a firefighting agency that is primarily responsible for the future, not the past. Their job is to do everything they possibly can to manage risk. The way we manage it, by the adoption of codes and standards and organizational policies and so forth that make the fire problem less onerous on the community than it has to be. The fire marshal is kind of like I hate to use this word because it sounds like kind of negative, but it's sort of like a code cop. Mm-hmm. Their job is to make sure things don't get done wrong.
And that's not a bad thing. I know when I rebuilt my house, I started off with the attitude that I think a lot of people do when they have to start dealing with the bureaucratic process of planning and development. And I quickly began to appreciate, though, that these people were there not only to protect the interest of the county, but to protect my interest as a consumer, paying to have contractors do work, as well as protecting the interest of whoever buys my house when I decide to sell it. Because who's to know what's behind the walls or underneath the slab? As well as, with new legislation in California, protecting the interest of those who may have to come to my house, whether it be the fire department, public utilities, the cops, or whoever, to make sure that they're in an environment that's safe for them. Obviously, it's all driven by litigation, but I realize these aren't necessarily the bad guys. And a lot of that's driven by things that the fire marshal oversees, building codes, fire codes, and what have you. The fire marshal's office seems to have professionalized, if you will, over the last 10 years, I would say, where it's become a much more career path within local organizations. Is that true, or am I?
Well, it kind of depends on where you are. The way I would characterize the position of fire marshal is it's probably the job that very few operations people want to find themselves in.
Oh, I can see why. Yeah.
Most people coming up through the rank structure say, please don't put me in the Fire Prevention Bureau because I like where I'm at out here in operations. Conversely, I would say that it's also being carved out now as a niche that people who want to be upward mobile desire to spend some time in the Bureau so they get a context for their career as a fire chief.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I personally never served as a local fire marshal. I served as a fire inspector when I was working my way up through the ranks, but I served as a state fire marshal in the 1990s with the idea in mind that I felt it rounded out my career from operational and suppression point of view and fire prevention. When we use the word it's more structured today, I would say that in many fire departments, they're beginning to recognize that the skill set to be a fire marshal is different skill set than being an operations chief. It has to do more with an analysis and has a lot more to do with political opportunities and things of that nature. But as we practice it across the board right now, almost every fire department has a different set of circumstances for a fire marshal.
One of the things that I was a party to a discussion at several years ago now was that as municipalities principally, and in some cases counties, are trying to scale back on the size and scope of fire departments, they've transferred the fire prevention, the plan checking, and that component over to planning and development or one of the other departments within the county or local government. But they cannot legally transfer the responsibility of fire marshal. The fire marshal is still the one that's ultimately responsible. What kind of problems and challenges is this creating as they basically bifurcate the fire department, take away some of their duties, but still hold them responsible for it?
Well, that's a very complicated set of circumstances. I've participated in the consolidation of fire and building departments previously as a fire chief, putting them all what we refer to as a one-stop shop. Mm-hmm. Where everybody could go one place. I'm not sure I'd characterize it as being a bifurcation as much as a division of labor and a clarification of roles and responsibilities. Those communities that have chosen to go that particular route do have an obligation to make sure that the fire code's being adequately enforced. You got to remember a very subtle difference between a fire code and a building code. A fire code and a building code are designed to deal with the building from two different perspectives. The building code builds the building and makes sure that it stands up, that it won't fall down, but the fire code is a maintenance code for everything that happens inside of it. So while a building department looks at a building maybe one time, mm-hmm. fire department looks at it on an annual basis. And the two of those are mutually exclusive channels of communications. Now, when it comes to the plan checking process and making sure that all the proper things have been done and so forth, adequate training of fire building personnel should prevent that from ever becoming a problem.
Okay. Very good. So for those people that are interested in getting into the fire prevention side of the fire service, what do they need to start thinking about?
Well, first off, let's talk about why should you spend any time in the Bureau in the first place? If you're happy in suppression, why would you even bother? Hi, Guy.
How's it going?
The idea is that a well-rounded career, you need to spend some time in staff assignments so that you have a global perspective. Remember that concept we had earlier about program management versus risk assessment? The fire marshal has more to do with controlling the risk in a community than the operations division does. So if you want to really become an outstanding operations person, you probably need to spend some time looking at buildings. And where do you get that? Over in the Fire Prevention Bureau. I think the argument that I'd like to make for this particular tape is don't avoid a staff assignment. Don't avoid going into the Bureau for a certain period of your time. It might be a little inconvenient. It might change your lifestyle for a while. But if you're upward mobile, it's critical to your decision-making skills.
Well, I think it goes to the discussion, too, if you don't know what you don't know. And when you get into the fire prevention side of the street, which is not the glamorous side, I think would be a way to put it, you begin to realize that it's a much bigger world out there and that prevention doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. It may not be the exciting thing, for sure, but preventing fires and preventing the injuries and the loss of life and the loss of property, isn't that what we're all here to do in the first place?
It is, but we're essentially saying that it's a philosophical discussion, and I'm going to be real blunt and say that most people, when you mention fire prevention, their eyes roll back in their head. Oh, my God, that's the most boring job I can imagine. Some of the most exciting days of my life have been involved in fire prevention, especially when it comes to dealing with conflict with major developers and dealing with fire problems that if I'd have stood still and let them go the way they were going, 20 years from now, firefighters would have a much more difficult time.
What are some of the, I would say, big wins that fire marshals in California or perhaps across the country have been able to have towards creating fire safety, not only for the public, but for firefighters themselves?
Well, best answer I can give to that is increased levels of built-in fire protection. I remember the first fire code with a guy by the name of Robert Gain. The fire code was about a half inch thick. It was a little green manual, and it had like maybe six chapters in it, and they were like 2 pages long. It was there. Today, the fire code looks like the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah, you need a forklift.
You need a forklift to pick it up. A significant amount of the work that's been gone has been conducted over the last 20 years has been to increase the level of built-in fire protection and reduce the possibility of catastrophic fire.
As from the fire marshal's point of view, which doesn't necessarily coincide exactly with the fire chief's point of view in some cases, I should think, what are some of the areas where the fire service needs to focus as it relates to fire hazard and prevention in the future?
If I were going to pick out a couple of really specific categories, the one area I have a personal concern about is public assembly. Mm-hmm. I think we still have an ongoing, reoccurring, and repetitive problem with misuse of public assembly occupancies with interior finish. And the reason I say that is we just still have major fires in theaters and restaurants and things of that nature that result in loss of life. Secondarily, I think that the impact of energy on buildings is going to change the nature of firefighting. You know why? Because we're going to start tightening up our buildings. They're not going to leak as much as they used to.
Right.
And your buildings are going to become like fighting a fire on the inside of a refrigerator. You got to go through a couple of barriers to get on the inside. Next, I think that one of our going to be a real serious issue for us to start addressing is what I call high density occupancy, high rise buildings, very, very, you know, dense occupancies, redevelopment of our communities. The American fire problem is not the same as it was at the turn of the previous century, which was mostly wooden buildings too close together with inadequate fire protection. Today, what we have is multiple changes in content, totally different construction criteria, and the problem is a lot more complicated than it was 100 years ago.
One of the things that you were very much involved in on a national level is residential sprinkler systems.
Yes.
And that's a huge prevention, firefighting, safety thing that's going to impact this country forever forward. How did that come about?
It came about, my personal story is different than my professional story. I got in the business of residential sprinklers because of the death of a 13-year-old girl that I observed on a fire, and a fire that I fought in a fiberglass boat factory within the same week. In one case, we squeegeed out the building and started rebuilding boats the next day, and the 13-year-old girl died within 2 feet of her front door. And it caused me to start asking a real simple question. Why is it we can protect fiberglass boat shells and can't protect a single-family dwelling? That's how I got in the business. But the reality is that it's been increasing over the years. Sprinklers are being recognized more and more as a mitigation strategy. They don't eliminate everything, but they certainly cause certain things to happen.
Well, as we talk about residential sprinklers, that was not an easy task to win that over, was it? That was a long, hard fight.
The old saying goes, it took years and years to be an overnight success.
I mean, I understand why it was such a challenge to do, but why was it such a challenge to do? When we talk about fire prevention and saving property and lives, it seems like that's not even an argument to have, and yet it was a huge argument.
First thing people have to recognize is that the statistics are clear. You stand a greater chance of dying in your own bedroom than you do in a high-rise hotel. You can travel 300 days out of the year and still be in more danger in your own home than you are at the scene of some place owned by a third party, like a hotel chain, whatever. The reason it's hard fought was the fact that the old idea that a man's home's his castle and he ought to be able to do anything he wants to there has been predominant probably since the dawn of time, and at least in real estate development in this country. But the reality is that's still where America's fire problem is. Getting that across has been incredibly difficult. There are a lot of people who now understand it. We have several advocacy groups now that I can't remember the names of all of them. I probably shouldn't mention any of them for fear without mentioning all of them. But we have many advocacy groups now talking to people who have survived residential fires and have gone on record as to why this is important. But it's fallen on deaf ears with the people who are the developers and the construction industry. Mm-hmm. They don't see the payoff. In fact, they don't see the payoff even in their immediate future. Reality is, though, that's America's biggest fire problem, is a single-family dwelling.
Well, I can understand where a contractor or a developer doesn't see the value in it, because the end of his relationship is when the house sells. That's it. He's
gone.
His job's done. They dissolve the corporation that built the property, and everybody goes their separate way. I can understand that. But for the person that buys the home, particularly one that's going to stay in it for an extended period of time, their investment is significant. I think one of the aspects of the sprinkler system that I've noticed is that there's so much misinformation out there, that if one sprinkler goes off, they all go off, and that it's going to destroy your house with water damage, and that they're extremely expensive, and all these things. That's all.
Gee, Mike, I only heard those arguments 30 years ago.
Well, one of the responses I heard that was kind of interesting is that, well, what do you mean there's a problem with water in the sprinkler system? You have hot water, you have cold water, and you have sewage in your house, don't you? And it doesn't leak. Why in the world do you think this is going to be a problem?
Well, it's the myths that you're talking about have been around since the dawn of time. I actually have information that some of the myths associated with sprinkler systems go all the way back until the late 1800s. I have no idea where all these myths got started. I can think that some of them are actually based on fact. You know, the early fire sprinkler systems, when one head went off, they all did go off. The early ones.
Sure.
That was 150 years ago.
Well, 150 years ago, we ran gas through all the homes and had flame at the end of them and used them as lights.
Oh, use it as light.
Nobody thought anything about that.
One of my funniest articles I have in my collection came out of the magazine called Argus out of San Francisco, and it's an article written by a San Francisco battalion chief who is arguing about this danger that is going to kill people and destroy town homes and going to kill all these civilians. And he goes on and on for like 15 paragraphs until you get to the final paragraph and you realize he's talking about electricity. And what he's trying to do is to stop them from putting electricity into homes. The residential sprinkler arena is a battle that will probably go on for 100 years. The reason it's going to stay like that is that there are certain parts of this country that are already mastering the problem, and their fire loss record is decreasing significantly. However, our statistics are not showing it yet at the national level. There are other parts of this country where they've successfully lobbied themselves an exemption, and they will continue to kill people in single-family dwellings. I have no idea when the tide is going to turn, but I will tell you that I believe the tide will eventually turn. Simple reason is that we can no longer afford to keep putting more and more resources into a reactive fire protection system. It's got to be proactive.
Well, I think cost and litigation are going to be the two things which interrelate, obviously. But the cost of fire departments and what they all entail is going to be one side of it, and the other is what the insurance companies are willing to tolerate in the world of loss. And there are insurance companies getting out of insuring properties that are in the wildfire urban interface. I can see the next step might be to stop insuring homes that aren't sprinklered or that go beyond a certain age and construction safety and things of that nature. Another aspect of the sprinklers that I find kind of interesting is that even the fire service has resisted them in some cases. And I look at it as a firefighter safety issue. That if you have a sprinkled residence, you're not having risk or exposure, certainly not to the magnitude of a non-sprinkled facility, of getting injured or hurt.
Well, the argument that I'd make there is that sprinklers are content control. Mm-hmm. They're designed to go off early on in a fire where it might get kind of soggy with the bed, but you're not going to dump a couple of hundred pounds of toxic products of combustion into the atmosphere. And I don't know how people can ignore the fact that residential sprinklers do one thing better than anything else, and that is limit the fire to the point of origin, period. That's what they do. They limit fire to the point of origin. Once you've limited the fire to point of origin, other issues become secondary. You don't have to worry about ventilation. You don't have to worry about fire attack. What you need to worry about is getting in there and turning it off.
Mm-hmm. And yet, it's been in the industrial world, commercial world, I should say, for decades and decades. Nobody thinks anything about it, but there seems to be resistance in the residential market, even though there's been great advancements in the sprinkler head and piping and support mechanics that are involved in a residential sprinkler system.
We've got a knowledgeable body of fire marshals who now understand the concept. We have a significant number of fire chiefs who understand the concept. You know what's the missing component? Is knowledgeable politicians and knowledgeable city managers. Once those two groups get a tipping point of people that kind of get the story and get the big picture, I think we'll see a different outcome.
I would agree. Well, that brings us to the end of this segment. Any closing thoughts?
Well, we started this off with talking about fire marshal. And one of the things I'd like to say about the fire marshal's job is I think it's underappreciated and misunderstood in many cases. The fire marshal is everybody's best friend. Their job is to make sure that businesses stay in businesses, homes stay homes, and everybody goes home safe.
Until next time, let's be safe out there.
This has been Table Talk with Ronald J. Coleman and Michael S. Williams, produced and distributed by the Fire Services Training Institute. Production assistance by Mark A. Ward. Special thanks to Chief Michael Dyer and the Santa Barbara County Fire Department. Remember, train like your life depends on it. Because it does.
Table Talk programming is intended for personal and organizational use only. Any duplication or commercial use is prohibited.